My name is Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill.
Four, three, two,
one more time.
Hey there, welcome back for another edition of Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill podcast. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Chicago Magazine and Hungry Magazine, and you can find all of our podcasts at www.chicagomag.com or www.hungrymag.com. This month I sit down with Chef Sean Eastwood of Isabella Estatoria in suburban Geneva. Eastwood made a name for himself with Mediterranean-influenced rustic presentations like Moroccan spiced duck and olive brine pork fillet. Now he and his partner Dean Georgelos are bringing their show to the city with a new spot, Olo, located at 1152 West Randolph. Enjoy the interview.
Let's talk about the name. I know Olo, it stands for olive oil, lemons, and oregano, which is the base of Mediterranean cooking. I had heard that you had gone through like 100 names or something like that.
Yeah, it was definitely a long process to actually come up with the name. And the reason why we took such a painstaking process was the fact that we wanted something that was going to be original. So many great names are out there for restaurants in the United States, and we want something that would stand on its own, not only here in Chicago, but also nationwide. And we just figured that Olo was something that people could easily remember. It stood for the what we consider to be the cornerstone ingredients of Mediterranean cuisine: olives, lemon, oregano. We use them in so many dishes during the course of the day, you know, so it kind of made sense and it had a nice ring to it.
Were there some memorable ones that didn't make the cut?
There were quite a few, but, you know, I think chefs and restaurateurs in general just share the same passion when it comes to ingredients, and that was something we wanted to include in the name. And so many ingredients that we use are being used already for restaurant names: pichaline, quince, medjool, all great names for restaurants. But once you do your research and you start looking around, we didn't want to duplicate something that somebody else was doing.
I know I read you spent probably like the equivalent of like 2.5 years traveling all around like Spain and the Mediterranean.
Yeah, I kind of made a point when I was working in San Francisco. I was working at a Greek restaurant called Kokari. I had an opportunity to go travel throughout Greece and throughout Turkey and just really get a chance to see the food firsthand. Because many of my friends had said to me, when you go to those countries, make sure you take your time to meet up with families and eat in homes in opposed to going to restaurants, because that's where all the great food is.
What is the biggest difference between, you know, what we're used to here and what people are doing in their homes?
I think it's the care and the time. I mean, when it comes to Mediterranean food, it's all about the slow food movement and making sure that everything's prepared from scratch. And I think you truly see the love and the care that goes into the food when you go into somebody's house.
Yeah, I know. It's like one of the cornerstones of Greek cooking is the gyro. And I think it's really interesting because I wrote a story last year about it. And it's like 80% of the gyros that you see are like pre-frozen form product from Chicago. You know, these big conglomerates. And there's almost nobody does like a handmade gyro anymore, where they layer the lamb and the beef and season it and cure it for a couple of days. And it's. But when you have one, it's amazing. Like the Parthenon over here actually does it. They do it by hand.
Yeah, and it goes back to everything with cooking. I mean, if everything's done with love from scratch, I mean, you're gonna see the results on the plate. You're gonna see the results in the food that you eat.
How did that trip change your cooking? Was there anything where you were like inspired to do some new dishes?
Well, my background is classical French, and that's something I was doing for many, many years. And it was only when I was in San Francisco and I had the opportunity to work in a Greek restaurant that I really was introduced to the whole idea of Mediterranean food and the simplicity of the ingredients and just making sure that those shine through. So that was something that, you know, when it comes to French food, there is the seasonality, but often the flavors are masked or there's some other ingredients that are added in there that take away, I think, sometimes from the purity of the flavors.
You talk about the seasonal and the local producers and purveyors. I think I'd read one of the reasons that you were excited about coming to the city to open a place was that, you know, you have a greater selection of vendors or people who are willing to come to the city as opposed to where you are in Geneva. I wondered about this whole idea of, as somebody who's been very successful in the suburbs, you know, why not stay there, or, you know, why come to the city? Is that like a challenge? Do you see that as like a new frontier? And then maybe what you see as some of those differences between opening a restaurant here versus opening in, say, Geneva.
Well, to be frank, I mean, the farmer market here in Chicago is definitely above and beyond anything we have in the suburbs. And to be in touch with all those farmers and to have access to those farmers that I can use all year round. I mean, I have actually tapped into a few farmers locally in Geneva, and I think I've noticed in the last 4 or 5 years since I've been here that the farmers markets are increasing in volume, that people are embracing a lot more. But I've also found that the Green City Market in Chicago is definitely where most of the vendors that I'd like to do business with go on a daily basis. And so I'm really looking forward to coming into Chicago, tapping into the farmers markets, but also dealing with farmers that are here delivering to the restaurants on a daily basis. I have a good friend, Paul Veron, who owns V Restaurant in Western Springs, and he has put me in touch with a lot of different farmers in this area, and just getting back to that whole feeling that we had in California, where every single day you go to a farmers market and that's where you get your produce.
Do you see this as coming to the city as a challenge for you as well? Is it like something that you want to...
Definitely. We're not underestimating the fact that in Chicago there's many fabulous restaurants. But I'm a firm believer in that if you come in with a good attitude and you definitely want to do the best you can possibly do, you'll receive the recognition from that.
How did you guys choose the Randolph Corridor? I know it's sort of been a hot restaurant corridor, but... You know, I know Salt is just closed, you know, right down the road mm-hmm. from where you guys are going to be. Not that, you know, I don't think that's any portent. But I'm curious, how did you choose that neighborhood?
There's so much history when it comes to the meatpacking facilities around there and the markets and the warehouses. I mean, that's where it seems like the center of Chicago when it comes to the basic warehouses. That seems like it's you know, past the test of time. And to be frank, when we first saw the space, we completely fell in love with it. I mean,
I heard it was an old meatpacking.
It is, but when they retrofit the building, they basically didn't do a great deal to it. It's got exposed brick walls, hardwood floors, these wonderful like 16-foot high ceilings, and exposed wood beams on the ceiling, and it's just all the natural elements are there.
Geneva's kind of hot. I know Jeremy Lycan at Niche is mm-hmm. down there, and I just spoke with him, and it seems like he's doing some really good stuff. How did you guys even decide to go into Geneva first? I wonder, is there a big burgeoning scene now, or people really...
Definitely saw some potential there when we first arrived. I've been in Chicagoland area for about 4 or 5 years now. When we first moved out there, there wasn't a great deal going on. 302 West was definitely the point restaurant that we were literally the other end of the block from. They were doing a great job over there, and we figured that this was a market that we could definitely start moving into. And we've been incredibly lucky, incredibly well received, and you know, people have been super nice to us. And just over the course of the last few years, we've just always been thinking about moving into Chicago because this is really where we'd like to be.
You worked in a Michelin 2-star?
Yes, I was fortunate enough when I was working in England and France, I got the chance to stage and also work with some incredible chefs. Raymond Blanc was one of my mentors when I was growing up. I worked at Le Manoir Cat Saison and also worked with Paul Bocuse.
The reason I ask about the Michelin 2-star is one of the things I've thought about a lot lately is this idea of you should always seek excellence, and there's no question about it, but for many years people have said like Chicago is like a meat and potatoes town, and I think we've shed that brilliantly in the last few years. But one thing I think is true about Chicago, I mean, we certainly like to go out and dine, and we like a nice experience when we get a nice experience, but I think we appreciate great food, but we also like sort of casual nature of dining, or the convenience. Like, you know, you can go out and wear jeans, but you can go to like Outback and mm-hmm. get some like top class food. Do you think that because like with Michelin, it's like you have to do all the stuff with the china, and you put all this money and it's into the decor and it's not necessarily into the food. I mean, do you think there's a line there for you as a chef where you feel like you'd rather do something that's a little more convenient but the food's still top quality?
I think people's attitude overall is changing, especially in the United States, about their approach to going out to dinner. People don't necessarily want to go out and have the whole full-on fine dining experience, but they still want to have great food, and that's something we want to make our restaurant approachable for absolutely everybody. You can come to Olo for a special occasion for your wedding anniversary or a birthday, but you can also just stop by for a bite to eat at the bar. We want to have that approachability to the restaurant, and I think a lot of chefs and a lot of restaurateurs in the United States are starting to understand that now, that you don't necessarily have to have the best china on the table and the best crystal on the table in order to offer the best food. One of my favorite restaurants in Chicago is Avec, because it definitely pulls together all those ideas about it's fabulous food. You don't have to get all dressed up in order to go there. It's just all about the... And it's great atmosphere as well, the communal tables, sitting down next to people and enjoying a meal. I mean, that's what it's all about. That's what's... For a chef to see people that are coming together to sit down for a meal, you know, in a jovial atmosphere, it's...
Did you come here strictly for a job, or do you always want to come here to cook? How did you end up in the United States? Because you're from Blackpool, is that right?
Yeah, I'm from the northwest coast of England. It was just, initially it was a sense of adventure. I was sponsored by a French company called Relais Chateau, and they brought me up to the United States, and I worked up and down the east coast at various properties. I started out in western Massachusetts, a place called Blantyre, then moved down to a private island in the Florida Keys. And then I was very fortunate to be able to work at an establishment called Twin Farms in Vermont, which was working with a Roux Brothers chef and another fabulous gentleman called Michael Ricciuti, who was the pastry chef there. And that was a truly dream job for a chef. We had absolutely zero budget. We could cook whatever we wanted on a daily basis. The maximum amount of people we served in an evening was maybe 18 covers. Each individual table was catered for all their dietary needs, and it was a dream job. It truly was.
What was the craziest thing you ever cooked with an unlimited budget?
There was a crazy amount of truffles and foie gras on a daily basis. It was really just like the most decadent ingredients we could possibly get our hands on. And we also there tapped into a lot of local farmers and local purveyors, and it was so much fun to cook there.
It's probably an unfair question, but it's like I always make the connection. Is what do you think of Gordon Ramsay?
You know what? I have a kind of an inside perspective because one of my good friends, Mark Scanlon, when we were going through culinary school, had an opportunity to work with him, and he is hands down one of the celebrity chefs that actually delivers. He really does. I mean, he's extremely talented. Obviously, there is a lot of hype, I think, that goes on as well. I think there's a lot of things that are made for television, so to speak. But I think overall, he's a really, really talented chef, and he delivers the goods. A fierce man in the kitchen,
yes.
I might add. But
yes.
Most Michelin star chefs, if you've ever worked with them, are.
Yeah, it's a relentless pursuit. You know, there's a lot of pressure on those guys.
I mean, excellence doesn't come easy.
Yeah, I mean, what was Bernard Loiseau? They say he killed himself because there's a lot of pressure. So,
yeah, I'm just reading his book, The Perfectionist, right now. It's definitely an eye opener. I mean, we all strive for perfection, but there is limitations on, where that perfection is going to take you. I think, when you get married and you have kids, it definitely, from a chef's perspective, you spend your entire career, it's not really a job, it's a vocation. And when you have a family, you need to put that vocation into perspective.
So one of the things I read about that I was interested in was, and I don't know, Mugnani oven?
Mugnanini. It's it's an incredible piece of equipment. It's,
I think I read that... Alice Waters, they originally had a Chez Panisse. That
yes.
was like the oven that they used.
That's right. And I believe we're one of the first restaurants in Chicago to be using their ovens. They come from Tuscany, and what happened was at the end of the Second World War in Italy, a lot of the villages were destroyed, and they actually commissioned a gentleman to build ovens, basically a refractory clay oven that was easy to assemble, that would retain a lot of heat. Silvano Valentino, and he still owns the factory. In fact, his son has taken on, Mosimo Valentino has actually taken over the factory, and Mugnanini are the sole importers of these ovens into the United States. And myself and my chef had an opportunity a couple of weeks ago to fly out to California to their factory and see how the ovens were built, got a chance to play, and just the opportunities we have ahead of ourselves for this oven is really exciting.
Wood-fired, is that right?
It's going to be a wood-fired oven. We're going to use primarily almond wood. We're hoping on a daily basis to make a lot of breads in the oven first thing in the morning. The idea is that the coals at the end of the evening, you rake them across the base of the oven. So it keeps the base of the oven at a nice temperature. So when you come in the morning, you clean out the oven, it's all ready for you to bake the bread. And then during the course of the morning, we're going to use it for a different roasting of meats, vegetables. We have a wonderful pork belly dish on the menu. I'm looking forward to doing a slow roasted pork belly in the wood fired oven.
Why almond? Does it have any particular characteristic?
It's a good happy medium when it comes to the burning elements. It definitely retains a lot of heat. It's a nice compact wood, so therefore when it burns, it definitely burns a little bit slower, but it gives you a good reaction time.
Bread baking, a lot of restaurants don't do that, so that's kind of interesting. A lot of people farm that out because it's such a difficult occupation.
Well, I'm definitely going to be realistic about the amount of breads that we can produce out of the oven. It's about, from the diameter across the oven, it's about a 5-foot radius, so therefore I haven't got a particularly large surface area to bake all the breads, but we're definitely going to start out primarily to do the breads for our cheese service initially, maybe some of the specialty breads we're going to be using to accompany dishes on the menu. I would like to think that later on down the road we could possibly maybe move on to doing the entire bread for the restaurant, but we've been dealing with Red Hen Bakery here in Chicago, who do an exceptional job.
Are you envisioning a lot of sort of ceramic or clay dishes with like roast fish and things like that in the oven?
We have a Moroccan dish, lamb shank tangine, which we're going to be doing out of the wood-fired oven as well, which is a dish we've been playing around with at Isabella's for quite some time, and we bought some beautiful clay pots, and we're also bringing in a lot of heat ceramics out of Sausalito to be using for the oven-to-table items, so we're excited.
That'll be great.
For sure.
Since we're talking about the menu, I noticed some things on there that they sounded really good to me, and I thought maybe you'd talk about them a little bit. One was the Katafi crusted Gulf shrimp with citrus savoy cabbage slaw and tarragon grapefruit aioli. That sounds...
Well, we're definitely going into the citrus season now with the winter approaching, so it was a good pairing between the Kataifi. And just a kind of a throwback to my working at Greek restaurants, the Kataifi, you wrap it around the outside of the shrimp and it gives us an incredible texture on the outside, and then we're going to finish off inside the wood-fired oven. It's served over a slaw that's made with jicama and some red cabbage and some carrots. And then we're making a tarragon and grapefruit aioli to accompany it, and a tarragon and grapefruit dressing to go with the coleslaw.
Tell me about the kataifi. It's not something, I know it's like a pastry dough or something like that, right?
It's basically a shredded phyllo. It's very, very fine. It comes in long strips, and we're going to take that, and after we pané the shrimp, we're going to wrap it around the outside.
And then I saw you have veal ravioli two-way with braised cheek, and I thought what I really liked was this idea of mousseline sweetbread pyramid.
That's just kind of an ode to the decadence of the dish itself. It really is. I mean, veal is one of my favorite components to use, and the idea of taking the braised cheeks and doing one component, and I'm going to take the sweetbreads and glaze them down, so it's going to be more of a braised meat filling in one of the raviolis, and inside the pyramid is going to be some glazed sweetbreads with a celery puree.
Do you do a lot of offal meat? I mean, I know that's like, I feel like that's growing. People are really interested in it now because of foie gras, and I think people are like, well, what else is out there? And yeah, I love it. But yeah.
I think coming into Chicago, the audience is going to be there that are going to be somewhat receptive to it. We've had a great deal of positive response from using those ingredients out at Isabella's in Geneva, but I think the clientele in Chicago are going to, their minds are a little bit more open to the ingredients, and they're also more educated to a certain degree. Like I say, though, the people at Isabella's, I mean, we've really kind of got their trust when it comes to what we're putting on the menu, and I feel that, you know, we can bring a few of those dishes from Geneva into the city.
I heard your mother was a big influence, and you guys used to go to markets together a lot when you were growing up. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, Blackpool's on the northwest coast of England, so we're right by the sea, and the great abundance of fabulous seafood on a daily basis. And she was always one for not necessarily going to the supermarkets and going out to the farmers' markets. We rarely had like an abundance of food in the refrigerator, and the reason being is because she wanted to go out, buy the ingredients for that day, cook the meal for that day, and then start afresh. She is an incredible cook, and you know, I definitely got a lot of inspiration from when I was growing up, was basically just sitting at the end of the kitchen counter and watching her prepare what she got from the market. It was a lot of fun.
You got really good reviews at Isabella in Geneva. You know, I know Phil Vitale said some really good things about you at the Tribune. And do you have any sense, like when he was in the house, did you know, or did you get a sense, or how, you know, do you ever, you know, I don't know. I always wonder about that. I know some people say they notice certain behaviors, I wonder.
You know, I think he was extremely kind to us. I mean, we've been very, very fortunate. I would think that when I go out there and I cook every single evening, I definitely don't think about the possibility of food critics being out there, because I really would like to say that, you know, every single plate that goes out would be the best plate we can possibly put out there. So therefore, if the food critics are going to come in, then we'd like to think that we're prepared for that.
Have you had any experience with like website people, critics or bloggers? I know there's a big thing in the community now. People are talking about you know, bloggers versus professional food mm-hmm. critics, and whether, you know, bloggers, you know, have too much of a free rein, like they can just go out and say anything, or in a, on the alternate, it is, you don't, you're no longer just restricted to, you know, what Phil Vitale or Pat Bruno says. Now you have this whole universe, and so it helps in some ways. I wonder if you have any thoughts on
that. I think anything that makes you a better cook and makes you more aware of the fact that, you know, you're out there and people are coming into your restaurant and they're going to pay their hard-earned money for your food, any kind of feedback is good, whether it be positive or negative. I think we should be held accountable for what we do on a daily basis, and I think it's nothing but a good thing. And it just, again, it shows that people are interested in what's going on in restaurants and the food scene overall.
You spent time in San Francisco, which is no slouch as a food town, obviously. How do those two compare, Chicago and San Francisco, you know?
To be honest with you, I'm really looking forward to discovering a lot more about what Chicago has to offer as a food town. Being out in the western suburbs, you're somewhat isolated. I mean, my wife and I like to come and dine in the city as much as we possibly can, but I can definitely say, as far as San Francisco is concerned, it was a true re-education when it came to the approach to food. San Francisco was just so wonderful with the abundance of produce that was available. That's basically where the rest of the United States buys the majority of their food sources from. And I think that the whole Northern California food scene of like artisan purveyors and small producers and just farmers in general that are coming into the city, it's really a chef's wonderland. It really is.
I know Paul Verrant had I think he had hired a forager to actually buy mm-hmm. stuff in San Francisco to get a jump on the season last year. So, as you say, this is, a lot of stuff does come from San Francisco.
Definitely.
I know the produce is great here and the farmers are great here, but we do have a shorter growing season. And so
that truly is the challenge, I think, is in the winter months here, is to just kind of keep that sustainability. But that's when it goes back to, you know, just being smart about preserving the food that's in season, you know, making sure if you want to do some jarring or some pickling or some canning that you take advantage of the food that's readily available when it's in season, that's going to tide you over the winter months.
Do you expect you'll be doing a lot of canning and preserving, like agua dulces, and doing some really interesting
yeah,
stuff?
we've definitely been working on that now, and we've been trying to captivate the seasons. And one of the ingredients that we've been stocking up on recently is Meyer lemons. Mm. We take our Meyer lemons and cure them with salt and black peppercorns and cinnamon, and we let them sit for over a month or so, and that's going to prepare us for when we do open, although we have a kitchen out there at Isabel's, we can kind of stay ahead of the weather, so to speak. We use Roma tomatoes right now, which aren't, you know, they're obviously the season's petering out. So we take them and we peel them and we cure them and we oven dry them. So therefore, if we have to use a tomato, we make sure that we bring it to the best possible level we can.
You know, one of the things about the cooking that you do, of course, is that it's really based a lot on sort of the local ingredients from where it came. So, which is to say, like really good Greek olive oils. And, you know, there's two schools of thought, and I know you're, of course, a big proponent of locality and sustainability, but I know, for example, like the folks at Pasticceria Natalina, there's this Sicilian pastry shop on the north side, and they're very much of the trying to capture the taste of what's in Sicily. And so they do get a lot of stuff from local producers, you know, especially things that they're better served getting here because it doesn't travel well. But, you know, I know sometimes they get their bitter almonds, you know, from Italy and Lebanon, and because they're trying to get at that taste. Do you have any sense of where that line is for you?
Philosophy really is more about making sure that the foods that we serve at Olo and Isabella's are at very least indigenous to that particular area. But it goes just back to the general philosophy of if you're preparing food, it should come from local purveyors. I don't particularly want products that have traveled thousands and thousands of miles to end up in my kitchen because they're not going to be at the peak of their quality.
I've heard that you guys maybe are interested in doing some more in the future. Obviously, you're focused on this new venture, but do you have ideas about what you'd love to do that you haven't been able to do yet?
One of the ideas I've not particularly come across here in Chicago is just a great restaurant that's preparing food at a very affordable cost point. There's a great restaurant group in San Francisco called Chow, which has quite an eclectic menu. But the idea behind the philosophy is that the food that's prepared is fresh, the best they can possibly put their hands on, but the price points are in line with if you basically went to a grocery store and tried to prepare exactly the same food, you'd end up paying a more reasonable price in the restaurant than going home and preparing it. So it's a restaurant that people can go to 2-3 times a week.
I know I was really excited by the opening of Frontera Fresco and the Marshall Fields, or Macy's now. You know, it's like, it's such an understated thing. It's like in this cafeteria and all that. But you go eat there, and it's just, it's as good as if you were to go to Frontera Grill. And the quality of the ingredients he's using are some organic ingredients and some well-farmed stuff. And it just tastes great, and it's like $6 or $7, you know? Yeah. And not only that, but you look around and you see the people eating the food, and it's like people from all stratification, you know? It's like all social spheres, all races, and it's like you don't see that necessarily. I mean, Frontera is still affordable, but you don't always see that. You know, the diversity is amazing, and it's just like, this is what food is really about, I think, and you know, how do you encourage that? You know, I think as a chef, you go to like 4 years or three or two of culinary school, and then you work for 20 years busting your butt, and you of course you want to get the rewards of what you, and not only that, you want to do this thing that's your vision, and you know, you execute it on every level, but at the same time, you know, at some point, it's like when you are successful, you know, why not also celebrate and improve, you know, food for people, you know?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of my big things, is I want to feed people, and feeding people comes into various different categories. I mean, everyone has an occasion to dine, but we all, on a daily basis, we all need to eat something.
Yeah, you allude to this idea that food is about feeding people. It's about, you know, we've talked about, you know, it's about family. It's about your kids, or, you know, bonding with your mother when you were growing up. One of the questions I always like to ask is this idea of, say we're throwing a dinner party, you know, and you could invite anybody, you know, and it doesn't have to be necessarily at people who are living or dead, or, you know, if you could talk to people you're inspired by, I'm curious who you might invite.
Well, just from my experience in California, two ladies in particular that really impacted me as far as like how I cook and changing my whole philosophy, it was Joyce Goldstein and Paula Wolford. I mean, just to, again, I had the opportunity to work with some incredible chefs in California, and they introduced me to these people who are, in my opinion, just culinary legends, and just incredibly knowledgeable about food in general, but in particular to Mediterranean food, and that's something that I really feel passionate about.
Yeah, I read that you dined at their houses or something like that.
Yeah, again, it was really nice to not only meet them professionally, but also get a chance to know them a little bit more
personally. I know Paul Wolfert is kind of a legend for sure. I mean, what do you learn from her? What do you get out of meeting her?
Just her whole approach. I mean, the love that she puts into her food. I mean, she just put out a book recently about the whole slow food movement, and just taking the step back when it comes to cooking food. I mean, we all live in this fast-paced world where everything has to be now, but I think, you know, with Paula's approach to food, it's more about taking your time, you know, enjoying that time in the kitchen. And I think from a home cook, you know, if you allow yourself that experience in the kitchen, often people get kitchen anxiety when they first start preparing a recipe. But if you take your time and just make sure you're, you know, pay respect to the ingredients and take the whole process, it's so much more enjoyable.
What about olive oils? Are there some favorites that you have that you really love, especially like high end? I know people seem to know a lot about, you know, like the balsamico and now and where to find that. But, you know, I feel like olive oil is such a mystery. Like you go to, you know, if you go to like Fox & Noble, the high-end grocery store here, they have like 40 olive oils, and you don't know, you know, all you can do is really taste them if you can, but you can't taste all 40 necessarily. And I just wondered if there's some...
I think olive oil's like wine. I mean, yeah. There's so many different varieties out there, so many different types, and it really is a question of tasting the olive oil and figuring out what olive oil is going to work best with that application. We don't solely have one olive oil that we just stick to. I mean, we use various different types. We use one in particular that's called Manny, and it's primarily for finishing off sauces because it's got a beautiful fruit finish to it and very low acidity.
Is it a Greek olive oil?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. And from doing some research on olive oils, it seems like most of the best olives come out of Greece.
You're going to be running two kitchens now. You know, this is probably a new thing for you. What's the challenge of that? How do you do that effectively? I mean, obviously you'll have good people, but...
Well, there's been pros and cons to the construction delays of opening the restaurant here in Chicago, but it has really allowed me the time to kind of fine-tune the kitchen out at Isabella's, and I have an incredible crew out there who are more than capable of taking over the reins. But once Olo is established and once things are up and running, I live in Glen Ellen, so therefore, you know, it's close proximity to both the city and out to Geneva, so I will be spending time at both restaurants. you cannot be in two places at the same time. But having said that, though,
unless you're Thomas Keller, and then you put closed circuit TV in your restaurant in New York and you can watch it in California.
That's an idea. No, I have a very competent crew out at Isabella's. They're going to be doing a wonderful job for us, I'm sure.
Well, thanks for doing this.
No problem. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you have feedback, drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. See you next month, and in the meantime, stay hungry.